This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Rex Jung. He's a neuropsychologist and assistant professor of neurosurgery at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. I spoke with him on February 12, 2012, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in the studios of public radio station KANW in Albuquerque. This interview is included in our show, Creativity and the Everyday Brain. Download the MP3 of the produced show at onbeing.org.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if I hold my head just like this for 1 hour, then everything will be fine.
Then you go do a yoga class afterwards, okay?
Exactly. Get a chiropractor.
Sorry. So what do you think, Chris? Can we go with this?
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, I think we can work with that.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Good. Let's do it. So you know, I interview people. I actually interview quite many scientists in different disciplines, and those are some of the conversations that our listeners love the most. And I interview people who are religious and not religious, but I always start by asking, and this is my first question to you, if there was a religious or spiritual background to your childhood.
There was. I mean, I was raised Christian, and we attended Methodist and Presbyterian services when I was a child. And I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, so I was immersed in quite a...
Right.
Soup of alternate religious beliefs, particularly Buddhism and whatnot. So I have a pretty broad religious background, I guess, and in terms of looking at different religions as well.
And, you know, it's hard for me to think of a subject more interesting than human creativity. And I wonder, and then that's me. I mean, I feel I've always been interested in this. And I just wonder, where do you see the roots, or do you see the roots of this interest of yours that's really come to define your life's work? You know, did you start being interested in creativity as a subject or in yourself early in your life?
Well, it's kind of a funny evolution. So I started... It's a long story. I didn't come to this field by any straight path, and I didn't come to this subject by a straight path either. So I came to study the neurosciences through volunteering for Special Olympics and understanding how different brains work through how they don't work. And I wanted to do that sort of work and to... to do that, you had to be a neuropsychologist or a neurologist or a neurosurgeon or something like that. So I chose neuropsychology. When I got into neuropsychology and started doing research, I got interested in intelligence, partly in homage, I guess, to my work with Special Olympics and understanding how intelligence works in the brain, how it doesn't work in the brain. Yeah. And I studied that for a number of years. Over time, it came to my awareness that intellectual capacity of the brain doesn't tell the whole story, that there's other human capacities, particularly human capacities, that are of interest, particularly creative capacity, and that this might be something different than intelligence and uniquely different to human brains. And so I decided to spend a good chunk of time here in the middle of my career studying creativity.
Right. And so that volunteering you did with Special Olympics, was that when you were still, say, in high school or before you went to college, or was this when you were older?
It was in my lost years. So I my undergraduate degree is in finance.
Okay. And, now, see, that's an important piece of the story.
Yes. So I said it's a long story. So I worked in the business world for a few years, and became, I don't know, disenchanted or bored or something like that, and started volunteering for Special Olympics with friends of mine coaching basketball and volleyball and track. And really became more and more involved in that, and you know, over time I quit my job in finance and in business and started working in a sheltered workshop for people with adults with mental retardation and started moving in that direction. So that really started moving me in the direction of looking at brains front and center.
That's really interesting, and it actually is feels relevant to the definition, as I understand it, of positive neuroscience, which is this field you're in, that not yes. just what the brain does well, but how it can positively influence society.
Yeah, and it really was a positive experience for me. I mean, these are individuals, adults, largely with mental retardation, autism, and whatnot, and it's often viewed negatively, but it really brought so many positive experiences to my life, and I saw so many positive experiences in the adults' lives with whom I was working that there's really something very profoundly important and interesting going on there that I wanted to explore further.
Yeah, and that touched on this idea of intelligence, but as you're saying, wasn't at all encompassed by the way we usually talk about intelligence or our brains.
Yeah, it was intelligence in oftentimes its absence, the way we look at it in psychometric properties, and yet there was a lot going on there, a lot of creativity, a lot of personality, a lot of other things going on. I remember in particular working with an adult, can I say names?
Sure.
Is that
yeah.
okay? I mean, Alonzo Clemens, who's pretty well known in the autistic savant community, and he's an artist, and he does these beautiful sculptures of animals. And he suffered a traumatic brain injury early in life, and it's left him mentally retarded and you know, socially retarded. And yet he was able to produce these profoundly creative three-dimensional representations of cattle and horses and giraffes. And it's just amazing the creative capacity that he had in his brain. So again, that was one of the seeds that got me interested in the interplay between intelligence and creativity.
So at this point, what is your working definition of creativity? And maybe it'd be interesting too to hear how that definition has evolved. Like, where did you start, and how what's nuance has been added over time?
Well, I'm pretty humble about this because I'm a newcomer to the field. So I'm an expert in intelligence, but I'm a carpetbagger to creativity. So I've adopted the definition that I found when I got here, and the definition of creativity is something both novel and useful. And I like that dynamic interplay of novelty and usefulness. If something is just novel, it could be useless. Mm-hmm. It could be the word salad of a patient with schizophrenia. That's novel, but it's not particularly useful within a given context. And utility, mere utility, is not enough. It has to be something new. It has to be useful. It has to be also within a social context, so that novelty and usefulness might be in play, but within a given social context, it might not be recognized at that time. Van Gogh is a good example, where his novel and useful paintings were novel and useful, but not within the social context within which he was at that time. If we found ourselves in possession of a Van Gogh at this point, we would be quite happy, but at that time, it was mostly for his brother.
But there's a bit of a judgment call there too, that beauty, I mean, even including art, clearly our minds go to art, but you know, you were saying that those kinds of values, that bringing something beautiful like that is useful.
Yeah, and it's always in the eye of the beholder. There is a receiver of that beauty, of that knowledge, of that new thing. And so there's that interplay or that exchange, if you will, between the producer of the creative thing or act and the recipient of that creative thing or act. So there's that exchange that's important too. Hmm. It's not done in isolation. A lot of creative people will say that they do their creativity for themselves and it's in isolation. But when it gets down to it, often you can trace some sort of other in the mix, whether that other is in the past, in the future. Some sort of exchange is in the work. So that social context is important. Mm. And that's not my definition. That's a definition that's been worked out through, several years, if not decades.
So I'd like to really get a more granular understanding of what you do in terms of the mind research. I'm going to just start this off, but you correct me and fill it out. You're essentially looking at what is happening in the brain when in terms of creative thinking and behavior and comparing that, learning what characterizes that, because you can also compare that to other kinds of thinking. Is that right?
That's correct. I think, you can't just look at creativity in isolation. You have to bounce it off these other characteristics like intelligence, personality variables, things like more granular, as you say, working memory, attention capacity, some more basic cognitive processes. So what is unique about creativity and how the brain manifests creativity that is overlaps these other brain things that the brain does, and what is similar and what is unique. So we have to take various measures in order to understand creativity in its specialness, I guess.
Hmm. So what have you learned? What do you see that's been surprising and new?
Well, many things are surprising, and with most research, the more you learn, the more questions come up. So that's good. I'll be at this a long time. Yeah. But I went in this rather naively, as I said, casting my net very wide, trying to look at creativity and the definition of creativity and the measures of creativity, and that were out there, throwing these into a big basket and trying to find correlates, brain correlates of these different measures, and then bouncing them off what I knew well, like intelligence, and then bouncing them off of things like personality measures. So the most surprising thing and the most gratifying thing is that one of our hypotheses was supported. Usually when we make hypotheses, or when I make hypotheses anyway, it's almost 180 degrees opposite of what I hypothesized. So the fact that creativity is something different than intelligence is gratifying, and that we're finding different brain networks than we found to be involved with intelligence is interesting and rewarding, I guess. Mm-hmm. And the way in which the brain networks are engaged is surprising. With intelligence, and we have a theory that we put out in 2007, the parietofrontal integration theory. So regions in the parietal lobe and the frontal lobes, basically the back part of the brain and the front part of the brain, are integrated in a way that allows intelligence to work well. And the story with intelligence is more is better. Greater cortical thickness, more neurons, higher connectivity between those neurons, and more biochemicals subserving those neurons was almost invariably better for intelligence.
Okay.
With creativity, the story was more subtle and different. In particular regions of the brain, particularly the frontal lobes, less was better. There was a down regulation of the frontal lobes that appeared to facilitate or foster creative cognition the way we were measuring it, and I can get into that as well.
Well, but so when that goes down, what is shutting down? What is shutting down that the brain is normally doing if it's lit up there?
And we're not doing functional studies. We're doing structural studies, which I can talk about as well. But it's not shutting down as much, but it's allowing a freer interplay of different networks in the brain so that the ideas literally can link together more readily. So with intelligence, there's, you know, the analogy I've used is there's this superhighway in the brain that allows you to get from point A to point B as quickly and as efficiently as possible. You don't really use a lot of resources to do something that, intelligent behavior requires. With creativity, it's a slower, more meandering process where you want to take the side roads and even the dirt roads to get there, to put the ideas together. So the downregulation of frontal lobes in particular is important to allow those ideas to link together in unexpected ways.
Hmm. There's this term transient hypofrontality. Is that a description?
That is
a formal description of what you just said.
And I'd like to give credit to Arne Dietrich, who's a collaborator and friend of mine from American University in Beirut, who coined this term. Mm-hmm. But the transient hypofrontality is what appears to be happening, and both of those terms are important. It's transient. It's not permanent hypofrontality.
Right. You meander for a while and then you go back to being direct.
Yeah, because you need your frontal lobes later to push ideas forward and hypothesis test and whatnot. But this transient hypofrontality appears to be conducive for extrapolating out and analogizing, looking at metaphor and whatnot to pull different concepts that you have in your toolbox together and put them together. But then when you do pull them together, you get your frontal lobes back online and then hypothesis test, decide if it's a good idea, and then personality variables, which require a lot of frontal lobe activity, certainly would engage your frontal lobes. So this hypofrontal state is a transient state.
Okay. So there are a number of... I want to say what core qualities or indicators of creativity that are part of your studies. It was really interesting to me that one of them is humor. That's one of the primary expression of creativity that you see.
I think so. I think the expression of humor is a creative act, and you know, it's novel, it's useful, it fits the definition. It's socially relevant, and it's unexpected, which is another definition of creativity. And that's the definition of humor: is you're going in a certain direction, and it kind of takes a turn to the unexpected, and that's what makes it oftentimes humorous. Is that there's an unexpected turn of phrase or turn of events that makes something humorous. So we straight up measure humor in our studies as one of the variables of interest.
So it's interesting. Humor also comes up in my conversations with a person like Desmond Tutu and others who will say that humor, that God has a sense of humor, that humor is a spiritual virtue.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, we're all sunk.
but to me, it's also an example of how you're right. We've had. I mean, I grew up in the era where everybody got tested for IQ, and then it kind of went away because no one really knew what to do with it or whether that was responsible, or what it really measured. You know, what it mattered. And still, we our kind of cultural vocabulary about intelligence doesn't necessarily include something like humor. But the minute you say that is an expression of creativity, it's just obvious.
I think it's obvious, and certainly when we measured it, it was correlating with our other measures of creativity. It was not correlating with our measures of intelligence. So, you know, this overlap between it and things that look like, sound like the duck that is creativity made sense. Hmm. So, and you said something about intelligence that I want to correct. I mean, there is some cultural baggage with intelligence that is important to... well, correct.
Mm-hmm.
It's an important measure. It's an accurate measure, and it has many predictive capabilities out in the real world. And
the IQ, the fact that you mean?
An IQ test. I mean, mm-hmm. it's one of the. I mean, I've read one journal article that said it's measured more accurately. They've done a study apparently where it's measured more accurately than height in the doctor's office. Which is profound. I mean, it's been around for 100 years. It's measured incredibly accurately, and it has really profound predictive capabilities for things like educational success, work success, even longevity. So there's something very important going on with intelligence, so we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater to, you know, use a tired old cliche. However, it's not enough, and that's what the conclusion that I came to. So I think when you were speaking of being tested as a child, as I probably was, on intelligence tests, and they didn't know what to do with it,
mm-hmm.
I think it probably reflects the fact that intelligence tests are very good at predicting, you know, academic success and what you'll do in school and whatnot. But then beyond that, when you get into life writ large, it gets more complicated. I work with very intelligent people every day of my life. I don't work with a lot of creative people. So there's something else going on. So intelligence testing is very valuable, but it just doesn't tell the whole story.
And I mean, you also, I think in your work and in your writing when you're out there speaking, you are also correcting some other assumptions that are out there. One thing I've heard you talk about that really surprised me was that this idea that we've somehow gotten about the left brain, right brain, right? That if you're a left brain person, you're logical, and if you're a right brain person, you're imaginative, and you're probably stuck on that side of things. And you've said that that's just not true.
Well, it's demonstrably not true, and it's one of those tendencies. That's why I took a time to correct you on intelligence a mm-hmm. little bit, because it's just so easy to fall into these what we call folk psychologies, these easy kind of metaphors for science, and they have a grain of truth in them. Mm-hmm. All of them do, but it falls apart when you look at it more closely. So, with left brain, right brain, for example, there is a series of studies by a neuroscientist, Gazzaniga, and a neurosurgeon, Sperry, who were doing corpus callosotomies, and that's going to take some explanation. So the corpus callosum is a bundle of wires that connect the two hemispheres, basically, white matter myelinated axons that connect the two right brain and left brain to one another, and they communicate back and forth. And people with epilepsy were having difficulty treating epilepsy, so they decided to sever the corpus callosum so that the seizure couldn't progress from one hemisphere to the other. This would stop it in its track. There's no way for the electrical firestorm to propagate from one hemisphere to the other.
Yeah.
So in severing the corpus callosum, the left hemisphere from the right, they discovered that the left hemisphere, as you say, was more logical and linear, and language was often located in the left hemisphere, and the right was more synthetic and visuospatial. And this got taken up in the popular press as the right hemisphere, the right brain, was more creative. And that took off like wildfire. And so you have, you know, tap into your right brain to be more creative and this and that. And, you know, in our neuroscientific studies, you'll often find correlates in the right hemisphere that are related to creative cognition, divergent thinking, or personality variables. But that doesn't mean that creativity somehow resides in your right brain. There takes lots of parts of your brain working in tandem to do creative things. If you didn't have your left hemisphere, I guarantee you, you wouldn't be creative.
Right. Well, especially that useful part. I mean, it's like innovative and exactly. useful. And novel and useful. I was actually stunned and very excited about a New Yorker article recently that also said that this idea that we have about brainstorming as the best way to elicit creativity from a group of people and all the ground rules that go with that about no questions, no judgment, that in fact not just has not now been proven not to be true, but that it's never held up scientifically.
No.
And I just want to ask you about that because you've studied creativity.
I do. And we've been talking about this for some time, and the articles are out there for people to view. But Jonah Lehrer is the author of that article in the New Yorker that you're talking about, and I read it as well. Did a very good job of disabusing people of that myth, and I get asked about that a lot. Well, what about brainstorming? It's like brainstorming is the worst thing you can do, and the main reason why is because of this process of trying out strange new ideas, versus when you put people together in a room, almost invariably they will try to conform socially. And so you will get creative ideas, but you won't get as creative when people are trying to please each other than when they're trying to push the envelope. And so the studies invariably show that the quality of the creative ideas that people put out individually are invariably higher in quality than those done in a group format. So another myth bites the dust.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, there's always, you know, like, well, what about, you know, the writers of Seinfeld or Saturday Night Live or something like that? They work in group formats. Yeah, but it's different. I mean, they're putting out ideas, and they're very antagonistic, and they're competitive, and they're not trying to conform. They know each other very well. It's not a brainstorming session where you're trying to figure each other out. It's a different type of environment, and in this creative environments, there's where you have collaboration like that. There's often an element of antagonism involved and critical interplay as opposed to cooperativeness.
Right. So could we state that with positive affect and say relationship?
Yes.
Which includes antagonism, but also enough which includes enough knowledge to be constructively antagonistic.
Yes, constructively antagonistic. But yeah, I mean, Jonah Lehrer did a great job of deconstructing that myth about brainstorming.
Yeah, and so, you know, when I hear myself saying I was so excited, I know their entire industry is built on brainstorming, and I know really good, smart people who part of their livelihood has to do with brainstorming. But I think what I've always been aware of, I'm a reasonably creative person, and I just know that personality-wise, there's something about that forum that is very uncomfortable for me, and I just know I'm not doing my best idea generating, and there must be, I think it probably favors personality types, for example.
It probably does. It's probably better team building exercise to do brainstorming than it is creative exercise. It teaches people how to work together cooperatively and how to exchange ideas and whatnot. So it feels very good in terms of management and team building, but as far as generating creative ideas, not so good.
Mm-hmm. But it seems to me also, and this is a subtle point, but this feels important also, that the contrast to brainstorming, that there's also, you know, where creativity can be demonstrated, there's still there's interaction. It's a funny thing because with brainstorming you have rooms full of lots of people and they're all spewing forth ideas, but they're not interacting. And that article talked about some building at MIT where there were just all kinds of informal interactions and conversations that happened all the time, as you say, with people who got to know each other over time so they could be asking interesting questions of each other. And what I just found it very comforting because it struck home. It felt like, yes, that is how it works when it works.
It is, and it's more serendipitous. So you have Noam Chomsky at MIT rubbing shoulders with physicists and coming up
kind of
with
by accident, right? Just because he
accident.
Happened to be in that building.
Exactly, and coming up with different theories of how language works based on networks or something like that. I don't fully understand it, but because he's interacting with chemists and physicists and mathematicians by happenstance, he's able to think differently about his ideas. And that's one of the things about creativity, you know, getting what we call, you know, stovepiped, having too narrow of a field of view. Really stifles creativity. So being able to broaden the horizons and that magical building at MIT, the name of which I can't remember.
I wrote it down. It's Building 20.
Building 20. Okay, yeah. We'll call it Building 20 at MIT, that magical building where you could have this exchange of ideas and people running into each other, and it's kind of cold and dingy and people didn't really want to be there. But
yeah, it was not the perfect environment.
No, it's not. It's not this great, you know, Googleplex where you have ping pong tables and it's all perfectly designed to foster creativity. Supposedly, it's kind of a dingy old building. It sounded like to me where people were relegated when they didn't have like real office space for them, and they were forced to think outside of their comfort zone. And that's kind of what I think is going on in the frontal lobes in this transient hypofrontality, where you're getting outside of your comfort zone, where your brain has worn ruts in the road, and traveling other paths.
Right, walking down the hallway to get a glass of water and stopping someplace you didn't expect to stop to think about a certain thing.
Look at this person that I ran into.
Yeah.
And an idea is merged with another idea, and it's novel, it's useful, it's relevant. So I think that's how it works in the physical space, and that's a nice analogy for how I think it's working in brain space.
Hmm. I want to ask you another one of these ideas, and this is again as a parent. Now, this is one I've never seen industries built on, but it's something that's to me proven true in life, that there's a connection between boredom and creativity, or between not having enough to not having things given to you to do, and then you know, I think I've felt that with my children that when they actually are bored, it may be a really good thing for them ultimately because they have to come up with something. But then recently I also interviewed a humorist, a very creative, brilliant person named Kevin Kling, who also just talked about, you know, being a child and how back then he did not have a schedule.
Yeah.
And how much time he and his brother had just hanging around with nothing to do, and actually how much came out of that.
I talk to people about my childhood and how recess was the most important class of the day.
Yeah.
So there's the knowledge acquisition portion, and then there's the place where you have to let the ideas flow. And if you're always in knowledge acquisition mode, which is important, you have to put ideas in your head in order to put them together in novel and useful ways. But if you're constantly in knowledge acquisition mode, there's not that quiet time to put it together. And this gets to another important creative trick, I guess, if you will, but almost invariably you hear, how do you induce transient hypofrontality? How can you do that? Some people's brains, as we reported in our studies, are more set up that way to have transient hypofrontality, if you will. But you hear lots of stories of, you know, in history from Archimedes' bath, where he studied or discovered density by immersing himself in a bath and looking at displacement. He figured out he could measure how much gold is in a crown or something like that and cried Eureka. Yeah. But this warm bath or the long walk of Beethoven or Kekule awakening from a dream and imagining a snake swallowing its own tail and thinking of a benzene ring. All of these have in common this hypofrontal state, whether it's induced by a warm bath, walk, meditation,
there's free
exercise,
space in there. There's what
yoga.
We might call downtime.
There is downtime where your brain is not engaged in ongoing cognitive activity, even exercise is a way to do that, where you're just working your body, but you're not working your cognitive resources. And it induces this workspace for you to meander around and put ideas together. And everyone knows the trick that works for them, the shower in the place or the yoga class, or some people drink. I mean, it's a lot of ways to get there, but a lot of people know, creative people in particular, know what trick works for them to get away. And for your children, to get back to your question, that's an important space to cultivate that recess from knowledge acquisition. You have to have the raw materials in place to put together, but you also have to have the time to put them together.
So does this speak to how we want to discipline ourselves to live with our technology? Is this something you think about? If we're constantly checking email or seeing, not in my case, but in my children's case, who just texted them, are we then actually diminishing the possibility of just spaces for creativity?
Well, yeah. I haven't studied it empirically, but it appears evident, self-evident, that all of this engagement of your brain in activities through technology is knowledge acquisition as opposed to putting ideas together. So I think that's crowding out time for creativity. And I just gave an interview to one of the, Wired type magazines or bloggers or something like that. And he said, well, this is really going to upset all my blogging people. And I said, who are constantly on Facebook and constantly tweeting and blogging and all of that. I hypothesize, and again, I've been wrong so many times in the past that I wouldn't take this to
like
the bank.
Every good scientist.
But I hypothesize that that's crowding out time for creative cognition.
But it's different to hear it from you. I mean, in some ways, it feels like common sense, right? Like we could have this conversation if neither one of us was a scientist. But for you to know physiologically the conditions that we need to get our brain into to be creative and to be able to see the common sense that emerges from that about these technologies that now are using, as you say, our cognitive energy so much of the time. Yeah. It's dramatic.
Well, most science is just confirmation of common sense things, right?
Yeah.
We just experimentally support common sense notions, or we disprove, mythologies. But most science is just confirming common sense as we go along.
I do want to talk about genius, which is a little bit across the spectrum from common sense. That's something that you have spoken about, and also about the fact that it's not really been studied. You mentioned a minute ago someone who was a savant. I mean, this is a quality, this is a kind of personality that I think people are maybe more aware of these days, maybe just through television and movies. Have you studied the brains of geniuses, savants?
I have not. Other than, hanging around Alonzo for a couple years, I have not studied empirically the brains of savants or geniuses. They're a lot rarer than you would imagine. Mm-hmm. And they're different. So I think genius is the unique integration of intelligence and creativity. And we just wrote a book chapter on the subject that, if you have, again, we know people who are intelligent and not so creative. We know people who are creative, and that probably takes a certain level of intelligence. But, this unique integration of intelligence, creativity, and probably personality variables is particularly persistence, perseverance, all those P personality variables. That's probably the genius that is so rare. And I could not find any study of that in the neuroscientific literature, in the medical literature that when I looked. And it's probably by virtue of the fact that it's such a rare phenomenon to get access to. I've probably met one genius in my life, John Nash, who happens to sit on a board of a organization that I am involved with. So they asked me who I wanted to sit by at dinner. And I, well, John Nash, of course, the Nobel Prize winner. So, but it's exceedingly rare. Now, savantism is an exchange between exquisitely high ability in one splinter area, usually at the expense of intellectual capacity. So you'll have someone that can't take care of their own daily needs or is intellectually compromised, this broad capability of the brain that intelligence is, that defines intelligence, but they have a splinter skill, and it shows the incredible computational power of the brain, that it can do something like numerical skill so well, or artistic representation so exquisitely well, but it's at the expense of other capacities of the brain.
And can you also see that when you study brains? You can visually see that?
We're starting to see that. So I'm doing a study now of high math ability, which is, you know, a kind of, I guess, a splinter skill, if you want. And you will see, and we have documented regions of the brain that are beefed up like a muscle. So we don't know if this is genetic or environmental, but these people that are at the 95th percentile in terms of their performance on standardized math tests have greater brain capacity in certain regions of the brain. I suspect with autistic or savants, usually autistic savants, you'll have certain regions of the brain beefed up to support that savant splinter skill at the expense of other brain regions that are shrunken.
I wonder, are you familiar with the term that Einstein used of spiritual genius?
I'm vaguely familiar with it. Yeah, well, there's people who have exquisitely engaged or in attachment to a spiritual nature, I guess.
Well, he was. I mean, it, the context of the remark that he made was his dismay with scientists, you know, in the early 20th century who were creating weapons of mass destruction. When he had this, you know, beautiful view of science as something that transcended national boundaries and conflicts, and then chemists and physicists were creating these weapons, and he was very admiring of Gandhi, for example, who was his contemporary, and his examples were Gandhi, Jesus, Moses, Buddha, Saint Francis of Assisi, and he would say that that the dignity and security and joy of humanity depended on as much on these kinds of what he called geniuses in the art of living, as it did on purveyors of objective knowledge.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious about, you know, what that phrase spiritual genius, how that strikes you, and where does that fit into this view you have of the notion of creativity and genius?
That's a very complicated question. I think that particularly invoking Einstein, I think that with regard to scientific knowledge in general, there is a interplay between what we know, what we uncover, and dangers that can emerge from the knowledge that we gain. So there's a responsibility. And being human, there are acts of, you know, sins of omission and sins of commission that occur, that perhaps he was alluding to with, you know, for example, the nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
This knowledge led to some knowledge that destroyed life, and you know, now we're tinkering around with the brain, and it opens up some important and problematic ethical issues that we aren't spiritual geniuses, those of us neuroscientists who are in this field. I haven't met any Einsteins or other spiritual geniuses in my field, but we're tinkering with the machine that allows us to be uniquely human. And now we're starting to face some questions about what if we could make ourselves more intelligent?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, something like 30-some-odd% of students are now taking cognitive-enhancing drugs like Ritalin and Modafinil, and I don't know, 10 or 15% of scientists in a science article endorse taking cognitive-enhancing drugs. I think maybe as high as 25% endorse taking cognitive-enhancing drugs so that they could have an edge on other scientists, because we know that some of these medications, some of these drugs can give you an advantage over other humans.
Right.
What if we could electrically stimulate the brain? We're starting to look at the ways that the other way that the brain communicates instead of chemically, electrically, and we can manipulate the brain electrically to change behavior. What if we could understand if someone was lying by putting them into an fMRI scanner?
Yeah.
These are very important ethical questions that I don't know that we have the spiritual genius to undertake. I think there's ethicists and there's neuroethicists working on this question, and I belong to or I have belonged, I think I let it lapse. Maybe that's an ethical lapse to the Neuroethical Society. It's very important questions. I don't think we have the genius to address these very well, as Einstein alluded to.
Or, you know, this is a variation on that question. I mean, earlier on you talked about your work with Special Olympics and how those experiences with people with mental disabilities just changed your way of thinking about what it means to be human and also influenced your entry into science. One of the people I've interviewed is Jean Vanier. Are you familiar with him? He started the L'Arche movement, which is a global movement of communities centered around people with mental disabilities, especially Down syndrome. I mean, I think if Einstein had known him, he might have said there's a spiritual genius. But even if you put that language to one side, I think that's a form of creativity. There's socially useful, novel and useful creativity.
Yes.
Right? That fits your definition, but it's not immediately what comes to mind. We think of artists, we think of scientists.
It's not, but I totally agree that that is a form of creativity and a very valuable form of creativity, and perhaps something that we're moving towards in our increasingly complex society. It's not just going to be a product. It's not just going to be an artifact like a painting or a dance number. It's going to be moving groups of people together and motivating groups of people to in certain ways, and that's a creative endeavor, and humor kind of gets at that. And you know, circling to one of your earlier comments, where you have a humorist with an audience, really, it's either working and they're going along for the ride, and they're really enjoying the ideas and the movement and the rhythms, or it's just not. And this L'Arche movement that you're talking about, this is a kind of social networking or mob casting or whatever the term is, where you know people are really able to move together in a creative way, and that sounds like a new creative endeavor that we should start to recognize.
Yeah, I mean, if people think differently and live differently as a result of this. And something interesting that you've said that is also intriguing is that the traditional psychological literature shows creativity and intelligence linked at lower levels of IQ, but that above certain levels they don't go hand in hand?
This is the threshold hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, this is the kind of common sense notion of, you know, sitting around the faculty lounge and, boy, these people are all really smart. However, but, you know, some literature shows, not all, some literature shows and that intelligence and creativity correlates up to a threshold of about 120. And this is one and a half standard deviations above the mean, after which it tends to disentangle. This is a controversial finding, and the intelligence people will argue with you till they're blue in the face that intelligence and creativity go together hand in hand.
The but more you're intelligent right. you are, to, even the you more don't need a laboratory just to disprove that.
They will. I mean, there are studies out there that will show that the higher your level of intelligence, the more likely you are to achieve tenure and work at a Fortune 500. Well, yes, we know all that. That's not creative at all.
Right.
Achieving tenure is about the least creative thing you can do. But publishing research articles, patents, things like that that are objectively creative, can be measured. That's important. So that's the threshold hypothesis. Very, somewhat controversial because a recent meta-analysis found that by Dr. Kim from Notre Dame, I think, found that there's no relationship was no threshold that these studies in the past do not generally show that this trend being true that So mm-hmm. who knows? Now, in my research, looking at brain imaging, which was the first study to do this, we did find a threshold where both IQ and creativity were correlated up to about an IQ of 120, and that different brain networks were engaged by those below an IQ of 120 to engage in creative cognition from those above an IQ of 120 to engage in creative cognition.
So people could be creative on either end, but their brain would be doing that differently?
They were doing it in different ways, and they weren't more or less creative than each other. They were engaging in this divergent thinking in different ways. So this, again, supports the threshold hypothesis with the additional element of a neurological basis for it. So it's not just behavioral tests. So I think there's something there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, any good researcher will say more funding and more research needs to be done. But I do think that in this case, more research needs to be done to find out what exactly is happening. But common sense will tell you that intelligence and creativity don't go hand in hand.
Right. And you know, maybe it's just because of the nature of the work I do. And so a lot of the people I'm talking to might fall into this category of social entrepreneurship that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Because to me, when you talk about creativity, not always, but it often has some kind of, or certainly you can see that it sometimes has an aspect of addressing social issues in interesting and new ways, which I don't think is unrelated to the work you do, because you also talk about positive affect, the brain's capacity for positive affect.
Yes.
So, I mean, in terms of the common sense thing, I'm just going to say this, and I'm not sure this makes... But, you know, one place my mind went is that... I don't know. Just you're saying there's this common sense thing that we know that... Unfortunately, it's often true that people who are very intelligent and then also very powerful might, in fact, be kind of stifling influences, loosed from a moral or creative or human center. And somehow those things don't feel completely unrelated.
Yeah, and we have to, and again, we can't devolve to easy metaphors. I mean, there are highly intelligent people that are highly creative. That is true. And I mean, you can look in history and Da Vinci and Michelangelo and Marie Curie and Albert Einstein. I mean, these people are obviously at the pinnacle of creativity and the pinnacle of intelligence. These go hand in hand in the case of any number of individuals. But you also have people that are of lower levels of intelligence who are highly creative, and, yeah. and there's stories of you know, the termites who were picked for their high levels of intelligence and followed over time, I'm hoping that I remember this story correctly, but you know, they followed them over time and they ended up achieving, you know, well in life. They weren't any more particularly creative than anyone else in terms of their overall creativity. And they were, you know, business people and college professors and whatnot. But one person who wasn't picked as a termite because his intelligence wasn't high enough, I believe, was William Shockley, Nobel Prize winner. Hmm. So, you know, this is the case that disproves the rule. So the creativity and intelligence going hand in hand is not necessarily the case. There's people of lower levels of intelligence who have a high level of creative capacity, and this is probably the basis of this threshold hypothesis. Now, to get back to your point, the personality variables, which if I live long enough, the third period of my career, I'd like to really dig into to personality, because I've, you know, studied intelligence for about 15 years, creativity for hopefully 15 years. Personality, I think, is an incredibly important and fascinating variable. And you can have people with high intelligence, high creativity, and yet just not working. They might not have the moral capacity to push their ideas forward. They might be evil. They might just be miserable people. I'm really fascinated currently with Steve Jobs, who you know, people are talking to me a lot about him because he
certainly a genius.
Certainly, you could, yeah, arguably a genius. Mm-hmm. He college dropout. I think he's just a high school graduate. Probably very intelligent, very creative. Read an article about him that, you know, perhaps he, you know, co-opted other ideas and turned them into this wonderful thing that is Apple. Mm-hmm. But that was him that did that. But boy, was he a miserable SOB.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, and really hard to get along with and really miserable. So what's going on there? Mm-hmm. Was that conducive to the creativity of those around him? What was going on with his personality? Did that allow him to succeed? Is that characteristic of creative people? Creative people oftentimes, I mean, the myth is that they're magical people and that they're adept in all aspects. But oftentimes creative people are somewhat miserable and hard to get along with.
You right, know, and world, depressed and, I mean, no, they're...
Well, be careful now. We don't want to devolve into another neuromythology.
Okay, sorry.
But...
But I mean, there are a lot of famous creative people across history who are also famously unhappy, and it's almost like that's part of their creative process.
It can be, and we don't know. It's a chicken and egg question because I mean, you've got all these new useful ideas that the world doesn't want to hear about. Mm-hmm. The world kind of likes the way they've been doing things. So does that make you miserable, or is it the fact that you're so obstinate and persistent and pushing that Sisyphean rock up the hill that makes you miserable? So there's a lot to explore there. Mm-hmm. And I would like to spend some time digging into these personality variables. There has to be something positive there that keeps people motivated. But the downside is it sometimes seems that highly creative people can be miserable.
So another word that keeps coming to mind when I hear you is this, you know, what is the connection between creativity and purpose?
Yes.
Yeah. And is when you talk about positive affect is one of the words that's there in descriptions of your work. Does that get at some of this? I mean, when I hear that, my mind also goes to virtue. You know, whether you understand that in any kind of religious way or not,
I think I do. I mean, I'm kind of a closet I attend Episcopalian services with my wife, who's Episcopalian, but I'm kind of a closet deist. So, okay. I
understand. Not anymore. Yeah, now it's out in the open.
but so I really do try to understand, and I've described myself as an existential neuropsychologist. When I treat patients, I really try to figure out with them how to find meaning in their life. So these are patients that have suffered brain injuries. And usually they're not going back to that great brain that they had before their traumatic brain injury, before their tumor, before the diagnosis with multiple sclerosis. So it's often the task is to start a new chapter in this book that is their life. And that's a very existential question to really figure out how to find meaning in one's life. And I think I research about half the time, and I do clinical work about half the time. And my patients really bring meaning to my research work, and my research work, I think, brings relevance to my patients. And this work with creativity, I think, is important because I think it is a uniquely human characteristic that provides meaning in one's life. It really allows one to produce something that is lasting, meaningful, useful to others, and that makes you happy. Mm-hmm. That makes other people happy, and that provides value and ultimately meaning, whether it's spiritual, personal, familial. It really hits all those buttons, regardless of which one you want to hit. I think it's an important capacity that, if my hypotheses are correct, and as our brains start to unravel as we age, it's something that could only be increasing in terms of our capacity to engage in as we age.
That's interesting.
As opposed to trying to hold on to this intelligence, which will be slipping away.
You could think of making meaning out of whatever the raw materials of your life is really the ultimate, is the creative work of the everyday. Yeah. And of a lifetime.
It is. And being, kind of deistically oriented, I think this is it. So what we leave here as the residue of our life and our creative works is it. Mm. So if we're able to leave some sort of residue of our life behind, our creative works are an important part of that. So I put great stock in creativity for that reason, on a personal basis, if not for a spiritual basis.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I wanted to ask you about, we've just wandered into this, what you can measure and what you can't, because even when you talk about that residue, it's often the relationships you leave behind, right? The love you leave behind, or the lives you've helped form. And that too is, a successful relationship it takes every bit as much creativity as intelligence, maybe more.
I'll say.
Yeah.
And it is a creative work, and you're constantly, hopefully, not just doing the same thing over and over, but trying new things, trying different things, hoping that they're useful. And it's an interactive exchange between two people at the most basic level, between members of a family, mm-hmm. at a broader level, and between members of a community at the broadest level, that you can create, as you're talking about with this community that serves members with Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. This community is created that leaves a residue behind that is incredibly meaningful. Forever, potentially.
Right.
That is as close to immortality as you're going to get.
I want to come back to something you said a minute ago that was so intriguing about your sense of aging. So tell me again, so that you think we lose some capacities. We certainly lose capacities. What do we lose, and what can we gain?
Well, I mean, it's pretty well known from neuroanatomists that our brains are myelinating. The wires that connect up different regions of our brain are myelinating as we develop, and that peaks in our frontal lobes in our early 40s, and that thereafter it starts to unwind and demyelinate gradually, starting at the front of the brain and working to the back of the brain.
When you say demyelinate, what does that mean?
The insulation around the wires. So if you think of the myelin as the insulation around the wires that keeps the electrical current from leaking to other wires, and you know it's the same thing as the blue stuff around your internet wire. It keeps the signal going down the wire instead of leaking from side to side. So the myelin allows the signal, the electrical signal, to transmit faster and more efficiently. So that myelin completes its developmental trajectory up in our mid-40s, and then thereafter reverses. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we might be able to take advantage of that. Everyone, you know, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 47, and so I'm
just
on that downward trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so on that downward trajectory, and I work with a lot of patients who are worried about their cognitive decline in their 50s and 60s and want to have that brain of their 20s and 30s. And that is frankly unrealistic. Our memory is going to start getting spottier. We're not going to have that word quickly at our tip of our tongue. And that's just the way of the world. That's the way our brain winds down before we die. And however, this capacity of our brain is, as it changes, can be co-opted for creative capacity if transient hypofrontality is true. This is more conducive to that hypofrontal state. And there's lots of apocryphal stories about older people, and, you know, they're retired and that may be the reason, but older people picking up a paintbrush, picking up a musical instrument, and being creative, undertaking volunteer activities and getting more engaged and doing things. My mother started quilting in her 60s and is now winning prizes at quilt shows. I mean, she is enjoying herself immensely in her early 70s. This is something that makes sense in terms of the time she has, the abilities she has, and the way her brain is winding down as she ages.
So is this another way to think about wisdom? We observe, not everyone, but that many people become wise, which you could say is another creative capacity. Can you see wisdom in the brain? I know it's hard to even define.
I don't know anything about wisdom is the easiest answer. However, I think, you know, wisdom is probably the accumulation of this knowledge base and this back and forth between the frontal lobes and transient hypofrontality and lots of disappointments and successes and compromises and the fact that you've solved lots of problems in your life.
Right.
Successfully. Some people are less wise because they get stuck in the rut, I suspect, and they keep banging that same drum. The people who are wise, I think, have taken the creative challenge of life and solved it well.
Mm-hmm. I do want to ask you what the relevance for your work is and even for your life is. So Richard Davidson is somebody I've also interviewed who's contributed to our understanding of neuroplasticity, that our brains can change across our lifespans. And of course, he did that by studying the brains of meditating Tibetan Buddhist monks. But I find that to be so encouraging, that idea. You've just given a more concrete example of how our brains change in this sense, something that's being lost. But as you're saying, it's a dynamic process. But I suspect you get asked this question a lot. I mean, so how, if we assume that we can cultivate qualities like creativity or creativity with purpose, How would you go about doing that, or how do you think about these things as you go through your life?
Well, I think there are some strategies to cultivating creativity, and thinking about Dr. Davidson's work in neuroplasticity, you need to get some stuff in your head, some raw materials in order to be with which to be creative. So that 10,000 hour thing, Malcolm Gladwell talks about this
practice,
as well.
You have to practice, right? You have to
practice. You practice, practice, practice. Yeah. That 10,000 hour thing is probably right, or not 10 years, but it takes a lot of time to change the structure of your brain. Mm-hmm. And there's several studies out there now. It's, you know, the famous juggling study where they have novices who don't know how to juggle, they image them, then they juggle for 3 months, they image them again, and they see that literally a portion of their brain, a small chunk, but a portion of their brain is beefed up like a muscle in service of that concerted thing that they're doing with their brain. And that is the thing. The important thing is they're doing a very new thing in a concerted way, and their brain says, hey, if we're going to be doing this thing in the environment over and over and over, I'm going to build tissue to do that so that we can do it easier and more efficiently. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to be creative, pick one thing, get a lot of experience in that one thing, and do it over and over and over. That playfulness is a second aspect where you can have downtime, basically, and play with ideas, whether that's the long walk or the recess or whatever we talked about, bath, glass of wine. This downtime is incredibly important to allow that raw material to come together in novel and useful ways, this transient hypofrontality. This persistence is, perseverance is incredibly important, because once you find a good idea, pushing it forward into the world is going to be difficult, and a lot of rejection is usually the matter of course for people who are creative. And then research, we haven't touched upon this, but research almost invariably shows that highly creative people put out lots and lots of ideas. It's very rare.
And they're not all brilliant, right?
They're not all brilliant.
Yeah.
You have a lot of failures.
Yeah.
And it's not the one-hit wonders that that win the day. It's thousands and thousands of ideas. Picasso put out, 20,000 individual pieces of art, and I can guarantee you they're not all there.
No matter how much they would all sell for today.
Exactly. So we'd love to have one, but they're not all. He's trying lots of different ideas, and so putting out lots of different ideas is another trick, if you will. So those four things are pretty good strategies based on pretty solid neuroscience. Exploiting this neuroplasticity that you talk about.
And Richard Davidson, is one of the places, directions he's taking that is in looking at something like compassion, which is a virtue that Buddhist meditators are contemplating, and actually, helping people practice, adolescents practice something like compassion, which I keep coming back to this, but I'm not sure I've ever, really asked you this idea of positive affect that's part of your work. I mean, it does seem related to that. Are you learning things about how to,
We haven't studied positive affect. There are studies out there that show that positive affect is conducive to creative cognition. So I am aware that, and I have studied positive affect in other domains, if you will, but just the straight up personality variable of positive affect versus negative affect. But there is research out there showing that, that positive affect, and I have to believe that even though, Steve Jobs was kind of an SOB, he, at the end of the day, he believed he had some positive view of where he was going, and he had a positive sense of his mission with where he was taking it. So that positive affect, that cheerfulness, that ebullience about where your ideas are taking you, I think is really important. It might not come across as being happy or pleasant to other people, because that takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
But that sense of purpose and that sense of positive influence that you'll have on others, I think, is important. And there is good research out there showing that positive affect is related to higher creative cognition.
And how, again, just asking you personally, I've seen you somewhere mention a son, that you have a son. How does this science you've done, you know, how does that flow into, for example, your life as a parent and how you think about raising children in the world? What would you maybe do differently that you wouldn't have known before?
Oh, I don't know. So I'm a stepfather, and okay. I came into my children's lives when my son was 9,
okay,
and my daughter was 12. And I guess that's another element of why I'm interested in creativity. My son is, well, both my children are very intelligent. My son is very artistic. And so I'm looking at him, not as a scientist, but I'm looking at him as a father and going, he's really intelligent, but he's got this different thing going on in his brain where he just loves to draw and loves to play with these transformers and loves to do these different things with his brain that I don't fully understand. I would like to know what's going on in his brain. And to this day, I mean, he's does art and is an artist, his brain works in a very different way. And I'm still trying to understand that process about how the artist's brain works. As a parent, mm-hmm, I think, you know, trying to leave that space open as much as possible is important. And letting children explore that space is enormously important.
Yeah. I remember talking once with a rabbi named Sandy Sasso, who's done a lot of work with the spirituality of children. And she talked about how one of the most important things we can do for our children is just put some quiet in their lives.
Yeah.
Which kind of comes back to our idea about maybe boredom is it. But it's just, boredom is just free space. And what I'm getting from you is that creating quiet and free space in our children's lives is also a contribution to their creative powers.
I think so. I used to joke that, you know, and this sounds a little harsh, but the only toys a child needs is a rock, a stick, and a piece of rope, and off they go. Yeah. And they should be able to make a whole bunch of toys out of that.
Yeah.
And that's not original, by the way, but they should be able to amuse themselves with that. But I mean, we had the kids were involved in 4-H, and they took care of animals, raised pigs and sheep,
yeah,
and we have chickens to this day. And so they had a lot of time to do chores and other things that gave them downtime. Stephen was a obsessive skateboarder, and
okay,
you know, sitting and watching him just, you know, try to get that kickflip over and over and over.
Well, there's that practice that's changing your brain, right?
Yeah, but I mean, he's also engaging his brain in a certain way by doing something physical, but you wonder if how his mind is wandering freely on other things.
Mm.
So, you know, watching him, and I'm, you know, an old basketball player, but same thing, you can get into this so-called flow of a basketball game.
Yes.
And your mind can just go somewhere else completely, and you wonder where his mind's going.
Mm. My last question, you were on a panel on the World Science Festival on beautiful minds. And I just wanted to ask you, because of the life you live and the work you do, you know, what does that phrase conjure up for you? What is a beautiful mind?
A beautiful mind is one that comes to my lab to be studied. No, they were talking about genius,
yeah,
and but a beautiful mind, I have to go back to the Special Olympics days and some of the minds of the individuals that I met, and this sounds really trite, but those people, some of those individuals will stay with me for the rest of my life. It had a profoundly influential impact on the course of my life, and the beauty and nature of those broken minds was very important to my understanding of this thing that we talked about, positive neuroscience. There's something very positive in the brains and minds of these individuals that are seen as disabled. And that really, you know, while we were talking about genius on that panel, I always go back to the touchstone of my early transformation, if you will, when I decided to take this path in life. So that's a beautiful mind to me.
Mm. Well, this has just been really delightful. I had kind of steeped myself in whatever I could find that you'd written that a non-scientist could grasp. And but I hadn't seen people asking you, you know, some of these kinds of questions, and it was really enjoyable going down these paths with you. So thank you.
Well, it feels like a therapy session. I haven't talked about anything, any of this stuff with anyone but my wife. So,
Well, I thank you, I think.
You have a way of drawing this out, so I appreciate it. And right. It was a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, we'll have some fun making radio with this, and we will let you know exactly when it's going to be on the air and all that. And it's, you know, it's on iTunes, and we'll send you all the links. And if we may have some questions for script, and Nancy will be in touch.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Hello. Are you still there? Hello. Hello. That darn clock motor.
That's
the
what
clock
it was.
Motor. And I was looking all around and I thought, wait a minute.
Well, you're used to it because you walk in, you walk through here every day, so. And I could hear it was kind of coming up from there.
I thought, well, man, that speaker must be on or something. And
all right.
Hey, listen, thank you very much.
Thank you.